And then in the year 1980, as I recall, began a 9-year stint as Africa Secretary for the British Council of Churches. So I started my role as Africa Secretary just as Mugabe's Zimbabwe was coming to independence. And that obviously heightened the sense of expectation within South Africa. And my brief as Africa Secretary of the British Council of Churches was to engage with 22 countries in Africa, but particularly Southern Africa, given, I suppose, my expertise, and of course, given the reality that the world or international focus was, in African terms, distinctively on Namibia and South Africa at that time. And I had then the opportunity of seeking to, with others, give some direction to the British churches as to what ought to be their policy vis-a-vis the South African Apartheid Society. And I also had the privileged position of being able to network with a whole variety of anti-apartheid activities, and particularly, of course, with the anti-apartheid movement under, at the time, Trevor Huddleston, and as Secretary Mike Terry. The networking developed in the 1980s to bring into being a body called the Southern Africa Coalition. And it was a very unusual coalition because you had working together in reasonable harmony your trade union movement, your British political parties, with the exception of the governing Conservative Party under Thatcher, your mainline churches represented within the British Council of Churches, of which I was a servant, your anti-apartheid movement as such, your development agencies, and your other bodies who had specific commitment to liberation in the Southern African context, some of which were like the Namibia Communications Center, others of which were like the International Defense and Aid Fund, based in London as an exile body at the time. So that coalition was remarkable both in the diversity of its representation and also in the almost unprecedented ability of bodies working together who, in the context of much of the British society, might have felt even estranged. It also meant that we had to find a consensus which at times was respectful of some divergency of viewpoint in the context of the overriding consensus. Let me illustrate. The anti-apartheid movement from way back in its history had the slogan and the policy, comprehensive sanctions now. The British churches at the beginning of the 1980s had a policy of seeking to make the code of conduct of the European Union more effective. In other words, that South African companies, and more particularly British subsidiaries operative in South Africa, would operate with a kindlier disposition towards their workforce, give the blacks educational opportunities, give them training opportunities, give them black advancement in the hierarchical structure of the workforce, pay them living wages. In the rare moments of equality of black and white responsibility, think about paying comparable wages, shorten your working hours, have creches for the workforce. All of them very commendable things. But in terms of having a dynamic which would alter the apartheid society and bring about fundamental change, there was not the remotest possibility of fundamental change coming about, resultant upon the full implementation of the European Union's code of conduct, European community, I suppose, at that time. And so I was engaged with people in the totality of networking outside of Britain, like Leon Sullivan, General Motors, the person who brought into being the Sullivan Principles, which ran parallel with the European Union's code of conduct. And this became an international debate. And when then it became clear to the churches that the code of conduct was less of a tool for change and more of a legitimizing of British and European business interests to remain on in South Africa, that policy, such as it was no longer endorsed by the churches. We talked about corporate camouflage, we talked about codes of misconduct, and we moved into the realm of targeted sanctions, working, strangely enough, in conjunction with the anti-apartheid movement, who would have felt discomforted by the cautious response of the churches towards apartheid in South Africa, would have yearned for us to go public with comprehensive sanctions now, but in a very commendable way were quiet in the public domain of criticizing our stance, being aware, I suppose, that we needed one another, and that ultimately our goal of a liberated South Africa was the same, even if the means to the end might vary. So the churches moved in the 1980s into a stance of targeted sanctions, not comprehensive, mandatory, all-embracing, but targeted, selective sanctions. Why did we do that? We did it because, on one level, in the world of realpolitik, which also impinges even upon an idealistic church, I believe, we wanted to attain to the realm of the possible. And comprehensive sanctions would not have been possible for the churches of Britain to embrace in the mid-1980s. We also had a difficulty with our constitution in South Africa. A church like my Methodist church was not willing or able, and it would be a debate to see whether it was willing and or able, but it was neither willing or in its self-perception able to declare itself for mandatory sanctions. It had to be conscious of economic treason. It also had to be conscious, as a church which was white-funded in the main, though black in the majority of membership, not to offend its white constituency. Now that is an appalling statement I just made. It hints at a compromise of the gospel truth, but they too were working in what they perceived to be the realm of the possible or the necessary. So they could not give us a mandate in Britain to go the full hog, as we say, the full core for comprehensive sanctions. But they were able to say that if sanctions could be targeted so that they would not be injurious or harmful of blacks generally, and of course that was the argument given by the anti-sanction lobby, including Margaret Thatcher, how can you be harmful to blacks? If you went for targeted sanctions, it might be acceptable.